Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a space for those who are healing from complex and developmental trauma. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach, survivor, and thriver. The intent of the podcast is to provide helpful information with insight that can validate, encourage, and support you on your healing journey. You're going to hear stories from other survivors and trauma experts, featuring therapists, coaches, and practitioners. We will open up the conversation on effective trauma healing modalities, practices, and tools. If you are interested in trauma recovery coaching, as well as recommended books and healing resources, head over to www.thehealingtraumapodcast.com. And now, here is your host, Monique Coven.
This episode is sponsored by Tyndale House Publishing. Change your brain every day. 366 days to a better brain, mind, and life. Psychiatrist and clinical neuroscientist Dr. Daniel Amen draws on over 40 years of clinical practice overseeing the treatment of tens of thousands of patients to give you the most effective daily habits he has seen to help you improve your brain, master your mind, and boost your memory, and help you feel happier, healthier, and more connected to those you love. Pre-order is now available at Tyndale.com. Welcome. Today's episode is really special. I feel like you are going to be invited into a classroom. I met Maureen. She's actually my teacher in a training I'm doing with somatic experiencing. And she is, in my opinion, just makes understanding trauma and how it impacts the body so digestible, because sometimes it can feel pretty complex. And I just felt like I wanted to bring her on here so that you could get some more understanding of how trauma impacts your body and your mind and ways that we could begin to work with it. When I started the podcast, that was really my main priority, was to give information that's going to be helpful, because that's really what was missing for so many of us as we were starting our healing journey, just because there wasn't any real understanding about what's happening. And as I sit in Maureen's class, my gratitude is huge. And so by having her here, I really try to ask questions that will help you understand your experience better. So just a little bit about Maureen. She is a faculty member of somatic experiencing at traumahealing.org. She's also a certified interrelational focusing trainer. She's a psychoanalyst, emotionally focused couples therapist, biodynamic cranial sacral therapist. You're in really good hands. So I would say that this is an episode you're going to want to keep and maybe even listen to a few times and to share with others. So now, on to the episode with Maureen. Hi, Maureen. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Monique. It's really nice to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm super, super excited because I feel like I am sharing a treasure because I've been sitting in your class. The stuff I'm learning from you, as you are the teacher of this particular cohort, my mouth is just like dropped open and I'm like, oh, I just wish that more people could hear from you. And so I thought, wouldn't that be great to get you on here? And you graciously agreed. So I'm going to ask you some questions with regards to you know, the training that I am doing is somatic experiencing. It's one of the trainings, and that's what we're going to be really talking about. I might ask you some questions about another modality that you sometimes combine, which is interrelational focusing. So I might pop a question in there too. But for me, I love somatic modalities because this is what I feel is really the heart of what's happening for trauma survivors. So we'll dig a little bit into the questions and share it with the audience.
Sounds great.
Wonderful. Great. Okay. So the very first question that I thought about was if you could explain to us what is going on, what is happening inside of us during developmental and complex trauma?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll start with a big question, but one that affects so many people. And so it's really important to understand that when we come into this world, most of us, not all of us, we're really wired to, we're prepared to be responded to. So that when we express our needs in our little baby ways, we cry and we have different cries for different needs, we're wired to be responded to. But we thankfully were also wired with what to do when that doesn't happen. And when that doesn't happen, we either move into more shutdown modes or we speed up and kind of hyperactivate. So we either will cry more and more and more, or we'll get quieter and quieter and quieter and shut down in relation to our needs. Now, if that happens here and there, no problem. You are perfectly wired to deal with that. But if it's chronic, that becomes developmental or attachment-related trauma. Babies experience not being responded to chronically as trauma. That's a shock trauma for a little baby system. It comes in, for the most part, unless you've had birth-related trauma or other things that are interfering, it comes in with a particular kind of expression, usually crying and reaching and that kind of stuff. And it's only when that doesn't work that it goes to these other modes. When it's chronic and it becomes developmental or attachment-related trauma, we respond less and less or more and more. This pattern gets laid down in our lives. And then a third pattern, which is less and less and more. And so you move between shutdown and sped up pretty easily. When those patterns get laid down in our lives, we unfortunately are more vulnerable to later traumas. If we're shut down, we under-respond to our world and we wind up being harmed more frequently by not responding. Things will happen where later we might be able to get away or assert ourselves, but we don't because early in our lives, the pattern got laid down of like, that made no difference. So why do it? But later, it winds up that we will be traumatized more frequently by not responding or by over-responding or by some combination. And so that is how developmental and attachment trauma becomes complex PTSD. The patterns that we lay down of shutdown and hyperactivation leave us more vulnerable to later traumas, to responding to our world in ways that doesn't help or isn't effective. And then we get traumatized more. And a lot of people wind up saying to themselves, what is it about me? Why do I keep attracting or experiencing all these traumatic events? And this is part of what happens, is that the pattern of response is laid down so early, usually in the first year of life, and people are almost unaware of it. They don't recognize that they're either hyperactivating or hypoactivating in relation to interpersonal situations or events in their lives, and they have no idea that that's happening. So that's how the relationship between developmental attachment-related trauma and complex PTSD.
And what about when, let's say there was some attachment with, let's say, the caregiver at the beginning, but then later on, or maybe they're with the other caregiver, their father, or there was just some chaotic relationships and experiences for the young child, toddler, young child, that was repeated and that was overwhelming. Is that different? If you've had an attachment base, does that change things at all with how it's going to impact them?
It does. It does. And it's so important to recognize. I know, like, traditional attachment theory kind of starts when you're born. And then the first couple of years of your life are really, really important. But one of the really, really important things I learned from somatic experiencing and Peter Levine and some other people working in the somatics field is it actually doesn't work that way. Well, for one, some people come in with prenatal traumas. Things happened in utero or as a result of the birth experience. A lot of people have birth-related trauma that affects how their nervous system is in the world. Or like you said, I've worked with people and know many people who they needed maybe surgeries in the first months of life, first years of life, sometimes multiple surgeries. The body doesn't respond so easily or recover so easily from big surgeries or multiple surgeries as an infant. We call that medical trauma in somatic work. And nervous systems, they're not really, they don't recover as easily as we do later in life. So that can set up this same sequence. It can be responded to as though you didn't have good attachment. But it is different, like you said, because the availability of the attachment was there and was probably is taken in more than when it's simply unavailable. So if you have at least one good caregiver and they're giving you great care, even if you had birth-related trauma, medical trauma, you still usually have some expectation of being met. That when you express yourself, there's still some expectation that someone's going to respond to you in a meaningful way that brings comfort and reassurance and, you know, well-being that isn't there when you have literally no good attachment figures or unpredictable attachment figures, who I really want to say often were traumatized themselves. That a lot of times attachment trauma is multi-generational. It doesn't start with you. It doesn't start with your caregiver. It might have been in your family system for generations. And sometimes in relation to terrible events that your ancestors lived through, famines, pogroms, genocides, all kinds of terrible things that have happened, enslavement, things that have happened in cultures.
Yeah. Yeah. So it made sense as you were speaking about just that frame of reference. You know, if the body remembers that there is, it has a memory of being responded to versus none, it almost is a sense of like annihilation. Like there's nothing to fall back on. And that's terrifying, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. It's shocking and terrifying. And our systems, when they're shocked or terrified in that way, respond in big ways, like by dissociation or shutdown, or on the other end, hyperactivation, you know, or panic. And so our bodies start to respond more and more powerfully when we can't make an impact on our environments in order to try the very best we can at our whatever ages we are to regulate yeah. our nervous system.
Yeah. So it's so fascinating. I'm thinking about some people that I know who went through extreme trauma from a lot of them as babies. And it amazed me that they pass right over the sympathetic when something happens and go right into shutdown. Like that's just right there.
Absolutely. It's one of the most common things you see is that when someone had an environment that really just didn't meet their needs and they go into shutdown as a result, they can now, when something new happens in their world, they experience that immediately as a threat and go from novelty to shutdown. And because shutdown is often not a great response to newness in your world, it leaves people vulnerable to being traumatized because they no longer have the option available of running or even walking away, exiting, which might be their best strategy, or asserting themselves. So they're unable, literally unable, to protect their own boundaries. And when you're unable to protect your own boundaries, you really are vulnerable to being hurt by the world in situations where if you had your nervous system more available to you, you could better protect yourself. It's a terrible cycle that people who were traumatized when young live through and often don't understand, sometimes ever, but thankfully many people who go into treatments will be like, oh, you know, their eyes get opened of like, I don't really protect my boundaries. And then if they're lucky enough to be with a somatic psychotherapist or a somatic practitioner of some kind, they're feeling it in their bodies. And they have even more information available to them. They're kind of waking up their nervous system, which has been put to sleep by the experiences they had early on.
I'm thrilled to share that I'm going to be taking part once again in the 2023 Trauma Super Conference alongside 60 plus of the world's most respected trauma experts, including Dr. Peter Levine, Dr. Stephen Porges, Dr. Gabor Maté, Dr. Richard Schwartz, Dr. Bruce Lipton, and so many others. Some of the topics are going to be healing our collective trauma, understanding and healing relational trauma, somatic methods for trauma integration, navigating chronic pain and inflammation, and so much more. To register for this free conference, go to my link in the show notes. See you there.
Yeah, I'm remembering I had done with a group of people just to teach them very basic polyvagal information that they had no clue, just so that they would understand what was happening in their body and make sense of it so that they would know they're not broken. I remember one lady who was an older lady. She started crying because it was tempting to start to want to practice regulating resources and, you know, go maybe sit on, she wanted to start sitting on her balcony instead of staying in her room. And she was crying because it terrified her because her safety was so equated with staying in her room and not moving that she was kind of torn. It was like just terrifying. So for someone like that, who it's overwhelming, the idea, because she's so comfortable just staying in her room, the idea of going on her balcony terrifies her. What do you have to say about that?
Well, one of the concepts that we have in somatic experiencing has been really helpful to me, and it's titration. You know, the idea that we can do something slowly and steadily to support expanding our range of resilience, that those things that we're comfortable doing, and also expanding our capacity for different feelings and different states while being able to remain present without dissociating or shutting down. So for the example you gave, this woman could imagine that going onto her balcony would feel so good. And yet she was also aware of being so scared. And so a titration might be supporting her to just go and maybe walk up to the window of the balcony and just look out, maybe enjoy the view for a moment or two, and then walk back into your room and notice what happens in your body. And then in another little bit later time, it might be maybe go open the door to the balcony and just smell the air and stand there just for a moment, and then walk back into your room and notice what you feel like inside. And at another time, it might be, all right, maybe go and put one foot, one step out onto the balcony and stand there for a moment and look and smell and feel, and then walk right back in and notice what happens inside. And so the idea is to create challenges that are small, not challenges that are large. We often challenge ourselves to do these really, really big things without even recognizing that they're really, really big. We're terrified. When we do something in terror, it doesn't necessarily change our nervous system over time. It doesn't support the expansion of our range of resilience or our capacity to tolerate things, because we're terrified. And so we're already like deep into our threat response. Whereas if we make these little tiny changes that we can be present for, where we're neither shut down nor sped up, and we make these little tiny changes over and over again, it expands our abilities to remain present and to feel relatively safe doing them. It's really the route for change. For most people, for most of us who have experienced developmental trauma and that combination of attachment trauma and complex PTSD, tiny and consistent changes are the way to go. They allow the nervous system to more comfortably relax. We can't relax when we're terrified. We want to be able to do something without. Like sometimes I'll say, we want to do something without setting off the smoke detector. You know, if we had like an oversensitive, hypersensitive smoke detector and it went off every time we even blew out a candle, we want to do something so tiny that it doesn't alert the system that there's a threat going on. It might feel, your heart might, you know, beat a little faster, but not so fast that you shut down or hyperactivate. That expands your capacity. That expands your range of resilience, and that's what you want. And most of us will feel like, oh, that's easier. It's easier, but it also produces more permanent change. And that's why it's so important to do things slowly and steadily.
Yeah, I'm thinking about some of the approaches, exposure, for example, where they would say, just sit on the balcony. It's just an alarm. That's all it is, just an alarm. Well, that is, I don't see how that's expanding your resilience. Now, sometimes it will change, though.
It will. No, it will. You will develop maybe like a kind of dissociation that people might even call therapeutic. I would not. But I know that some people do. They're like, now I can go on the balcony because they went and white knuckled it for 25 minutes and had some exposure therapy. But what I would want for the person is to be able to go onto the balcony slowly and steadily so that they can find the pleasure of being there, of smelling the scents and seeing what's going on. And that requires a certain amount of the nervous system expanding and relaxing, which it only does when you feel relatively safe, which exposure therapy can't really do. I'm not wanting to knock any form of therapy that anyone has found helpful, but I want people to reclaim their sensory experience as pleasurable. And that requires that we feel safe enough, that our boundaries are functioning well and we can see things and love seeing them. We can smell things and love smelling them, touch things and love touching them, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, what I'm hearing is you're talking about being present. And if you're shoving yourself into the balcony, you're again, I can feel it. You're feeling the anxiety. Just do it. And you're all activated. And when we're activated, we know that we can't be present. It's difficult to be present.
Right. And the next time you go onto the balcony, what's going to happen? You're going to feel activated before you even hit the door.
Exactly.
You know, like the relationship between you and the balcony is scared instead of like, that was so good. It felt so good. And it was so lovely. Mm-hmm. It was pleasurable. Yeah. That's the association we want to build. Yeah. It's one where we move into increasing ease. Mm-hmm. Where our nervous system is just relaxing a little bit by little bit, which it hasn't had the chance to do maybe ever or maybe since we were a baby.
Yeah, exactly. I love this. I love this because this is what we're talking about. We're talking about healing, like real healing, in a gentle way that's going to be more permanent. And yeah, I love it. Yeah. So another question I had was, why, when we're out of the trauma, so the trauma happened, let's say up to 20 or whatever it is, now we're adults, we're far away from it, and yet our bodies still continue to respond as if they're still in that traumatic situation?
Yes. And so it's a great thing about the way we're wired and a terrible thing. It's the whole range. When we learn and we put things on kind of like an autopilot. It's called procedural action tendencies. So for the same reason that you don't have to think about how to ride a bicycle every time you walk up to a bicycle, you just get on it and ride. You know exactly what to do. Similarly, when you've encountered really scary stuff in your life, and your earlier example of someone goes from something new to shutdown, when your system responded to that, to a big event in your life, the next time you encounter something that feels similar, your brain is going to say, I know what to do here. Shut down. Don't bother figuring out what it is. Don't bother figuring out if you can run or assert yourself. Shut down. That's the answer. Now, this is not done by your cortex, by your thinking brain. This is done subcortically by that part of our brain, which is most concerned with our survival. And so it feels that it's performing a survival-related answer to what do I do with this? And it just shuts down. So then we start to just automatically, and further the concept of kindling, we do it faster and faster and faster to a smaller and smaller number of cues. We'll say, I know what that is, freeze. And we just go into these responses repetitively without ever finding out that there's a better way to respond. That's what we have to get back online, is what would it take for the system to slow down enough to experience some part of, not the whole thing, some part of what feels threatening, still be present, and try another option. So sometimes we'll have to remember. You know, like me, I had earlier in my life a big public speaking anxiety. So the first thing a somatic practitioner did with me was said something like, can you ever remember a time when you spoke in front of a group and you felt good or went really well? And I think I was like, well, it might not be a group, but I can remember when I spoke with three people and it was a great conversation. I was excited and having fun. What did that feel like in your body? Keep that feeling, really connect to it. Now, let's imagine not the whole scary thing, but what let you know that this event you told me about was scary? And we kind of come up on the event very slowly, little bit by little bit, while moving back and forth between the remembered okay feeling in a somewhat similar situation and the scared feeling, back and forth, helping our body to learn, oh, now I might be able to do that. Then it was terrifying. When I was younger, I've had experiences where it went better than that, and now I might be able to tolerate it. We just have to do it nice and slowly, and to recognize the differences that happen not outside of us. The differences that have happened inside of us. Those are the important ones for us to act and do things differently. We often think, let me change outside, without really getting what has changed most, especially with developmental trauma, is usually us. The abilities I had when I was one and two and 5 and 7 are very different than those I have as an adult. When I encounter something really scary, I might feel like I'm 5 again. I might go weak in the knees and feel like I have no strength in my body. In that moment, I feel 5 again. What does it take to remember my now body? Like sometimes it's literally touching your now body and saying, oh, I have long arms and bigger hands, and I can feel the just literal bigness of my body. I can feel that my brain works differently. My feelings are different than when I was young. And maybe you can encourage your now self to see the situation, which helps you to separate from that scared young one who you need to acknowledge and care for and reassure, but you kind of don't want your 5-year-old in the driver's seat. You want her in the child protective seat, in the back seat, not in the driver's seat, so that she can be, or he can be, or they can be attended to, acknowledged, cared for without them kind of driving the situation or the response to the situation.
That's really good. I think we already talked about, yeah, we did, about the relationship between attachment and trauma. So here's a question that I think is really important. Why is it not recommended to really dig into the trauma and the story, especially when you're beginning your healing journey, your trauma healing journey? I know that in the past, that was sort of the way it went. And I think still we have this thing that we think, I have to tell them, I have to share it, I have to get it out so that they'll understand. But yeah, maybe you can explain a little bit about why it's not always a good idea at the beginning.
Yeah, thanks. This is such an important question, because both people who've experienced trauma, but also therapists, myself included, before I had real trauma training, believe that to talk about something will increase understanding, insight, and healing. Not really recognizing that, well, when we talk about something that was really traumatizing to us, we can be re-traumatized. We can again live through the feelings, the sensations, whatever happens in our body, the shutdowns, the dissociations, the heart racing and feeling shutdown can all occur again. And that's why we don't want people to dive deeply in to traumatic events that they have lived through as a part of their healing, especially at the beginning, before they've had a chance to expand their range of resilience, increase their capacity. Those are the first steps, working directly with your nervous system so that, one, you can recognize when something is getting overwhelming, like you're starting to shut down or starting to dissociate, rather than recognizing it when you're like completely dissociated, you can begin to recognize, oh, I'm feeling a little floaty, or I'm feeling not as present as I was. Or maybe your practitioner will recognize and say, are you, you know, something seems not as here. Or the hyperactivation, maybe you can start to recognize, I'm starting to speed up. I want to tell the whole story right now, really fast. And that it's actually going slowly that allows us to feel the feelings, the sensations, and to know when we're starting to disconnect from that. So slow and steady, and often chunks. Not the whole thing, and certainly not the center of the most awful moments of what you live through. Starting there can just be like perpetuating your traumatic response, where what we're hoping is to support you to metabolize that experience. And that has to be slow and steady, with a real awareness of your range of resilience and your capacity to tolerate your internal experience. Now, that's hard, because in the beginning, you might not be completely aware. If you're numbed out or shut down, all kinds of things can be happening in your body that you are not aware of. Your heart rate could significantly slow and you're not aware of it. Your breath rate might be almost imperceptible and you don't feel it. where you have that combination of fast heart rate, but also shut down. And you don't really get that you're in that state. Even people who are hyperactivated, if you say, well, you know, you really are talking really fast and it seems really pressured. What? No, what are you talking about? We don't really see ourselves. And so it's very hard for us to be the person who says, oh, I got to slow down, or that's enough. We often need a somatic practitioner to be able to notice that and reflect it back and say, I think that's enough. Let's just work with what we've talked about so far and what's happening in your body to support that expansion of capacity and expansion of the range of resilience.
Yeah, because, you know, the more I learn, and I just keep learning so much more, is I really see that that's it. It's, you know, underneath all of the stories and what happened and how awful and our responses and our range of capacity and how we're able to deal with what comes up, the activation, the charge. This is it. This is it.
Yes. And I think that it's like almost counterintuitive because our cortex, like the part of our brain that thinks and tells stories, says, I know what to do. I should tell the story. But the cortex actually doesn't know what to do. It's just going to recommend something it can do, like tell a story. Whereas it's not going to recommend, oh, you have to change your relationship to those subcortical survival processes, the ones that control the speeding up and slowing down. And that's what you need to work with. And that's usually experienced in or around the body. Or like those shutdowns, the presence, the speeding up. That's not a decision by your cortex. The cortex is actually not involved in that. But that's what needs your attention in order to work with that whole cascade of shutdown, hyperactivation, boundaries, how you experience what's outside you, how you experience what's inside of you. All of these things are affected by trauma, by being overwhelmed. That's what you need to work with first.
Yeah. Yep. All right. So, well, you just answered my question I had written down because I said, how do we begin to heal?
They almost feel like exercises, and yet they are, I think, and here I'll bring in a little bit of interrelationship focusing. It's like the combination of somatic work and interrelationship focusing, we're forming a relationship between the cortex and the subcortex. You know, so the cortex is like, I want to tell the story. And the subcortex is like, I'm speeding you up and shutting you down because you can't handle that story, or this is my response to that story. And we want to increase the relationship between those two things so that it becomes the, oh, I can sense something in me is speeding up, or I can sense I'm kind of numb. And I feel that numbness most in my chest. We want to form a relationship to that because relationships make things both more meaningful. They increase our empathy. So instead of it being like, I'm out of control, I need to go and blast through this fear, with a more empathic relationship, it becomes, oh, I'm really sensing that I'm numb. Something in me is scared. And I can attend to that fear. I can feel it. I can relate to it. I can make a relationship with it. Even when I'm just sensing the tiniest bit of that fear, the tiniest bit of that numbness, I can begin to form a relationship. What's it feeling like? What's it wanting? What's it afraid of? What does it not want to have to experience? All of these things, that combination of somatic work and interrelationship focusing, is designed to heal from these experiences, not in the way your cortex suggests, but rather to involve the subcortex, which is really driving the show, right? Those responses are subcortical.
That's just so important for people to understand, because you know, we sort of blame and shame what we see as if it is like, as if it's a decision And I'm not excusing, obviously, behavior that's not appropriate, and but just understanding that what you said, it's subcortical.
And so the, just as you said, we're not excusing inappropriate behavior ever. And also these inner critics get going when the cortex is like, I'm not in control of how you just acted. Like you, like, I just, I don't know, you know, blundered my way through something. And my cortex is like, oh my God, that's terrible. With zero empathy for the survival responses that were called upon to get through that situation, where we need a much better, much more compassionate response to support healing. Because healing is almost always involves both moving out of contractions that we kind of go through in order to muscle through tough experiences. We need those to ease. And we need the resuming, or when you haven't ever had it, the building of a response that looks something like, I respond to situations in my life and then I rest. I respond to situations in my life and then I rest. And we have this lovely curve of action followed by rest, action followed by rest, that so many of us lose when we go through early trauma or extensive trauma.
I for those who can't see Maureen's hand, I often use that too when I have talked to people, but she's making like, I don't know, it looks like a roller coaster kind of, or it's that up and down. And that up and down, the way that I see it is, you know, that's sort of like more of a balanced or healthy, or however you want to word it, nervous system, where it will experience activation, but then it goes down, and then it, you know, something will happen, and it'll go up, but then it goes down. Whereas many of us who've had, started off being born with these self-protective mechanisms, we go up and then we stay up. We don't go back down. Yeah. Whereas, you know, you might be in a situation with someone else and you're in the exact same situation and you might notice, wow, look at them. They're just like the same thing happened and they're like, they're okay about it. And we're still all activated and upset and trying to, figure it out. Yeah.
That's right. Right. We get in SE, we would say we get stuck on off. And that our nervous system loses its resilience, its ability to easily and fluidly move between action and rest. And that's one of the things we want to support people to develop, a rhythm that feels supportive of them, of their being in the world. And that needs both. It needs periods of activity and periods of rest. And it's not so easy to support the, reemergence of health in that system. Can feel hard. I always say to my clients, just take it slow and steady. You know, when we try to push through, sometimes we push too hard. And it's really a more gentle and supportive touch that helps your nervous system to heal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'm still thinking about what you said about resilience, because that really is it. Would you say that resilience is that ability to be able to fluctuate up and down for the most part?
I think that is a big marker of resilience, because when our nervous system can do that, and like I said, our cortex is not deciding these things, just like I'm not deciding if my heart rate is going to be fast or slow. That decision is made subcortically. There's an evaluation of my environment and my circumstance, and subcortical processes simply respond to that. So if my nervous system is healed to the point where I can pretty fluidly move between, I do a few things and then I rest, and then I do a few things and I rest, I don't even need to think about it. It just is like, I need to sit down, or I've sat down for long enough. I'm ready to do the next thing. And it's just there behind the scenes. That is a very important indicator of the resilience of your nervous system.
Yeah. So you like, and you mentioned this a little bit, you like to use both SE and interrelational focusing. Can you briefly share why you think they are so helpful together? And I just want to say something about interrelational focusing. I had never heard about it. And then I don't know where I did. I might have listened to something you said. And as soon as I heard about the compassionate approach to it, I was like, oh my goodness, this is brilliance. And I'm now as well doing some training. So I would love to hear how you combine the two and why you think they're so helpful.
Yeah, I felt the same. I had learned focusing early in graduate school, actually, from a more Gentlin approach. And then I learned SE some years after graduate school, and I loved it. I found it transformational for supporting my nervous system. And later, when I became a teacher of SE, I was like, I want to go back to focusing to support my students to really understand the felt sense. Peter Levine was deeply influenced by the work of Gentlin. But I went back to the work, instead of Gentlin, I went to Ann Weiser Cornell, who has this beautiful, empathic, compassionate approach to developing relationship with all your different parts, all your different states. And I was like, I want to combine these two modalities. They are a natural. Peter Levine's work is so powerful. But sometimes, and it is relational, but sometimes it's not deeply relational. Whereas if you bring the inner relationship focusing, it really has you slowing down and developing relationship with your inner felt experience. This is so important for many of us, because for many of us, we don't even attend to our inner states. We don't attend to our numbness and our speeding up as though they are parts of us that are feeling things like sensations and feelings. They're afraid, sometimes terrified, worried about things, but because they're not verbal, we often don't form relationship with them. We're busy forming relationship with the parts of us that talk, and the parts of us that talk are often just criticizing us or telling us how we should do things or the way to do things. Whereas those parts of us that we're simply experiencing, viscerally felt, that faster heart rate or that slow breath or the numbness, really need our attention, really need our relationship for our healing, for our well-being. And so I started to combine the two modalities and also felt like this is so compassionate. It helps you develop empathy and helps those parts of you experience that compassion and empathy. And they naturally start to soften and even to begin to give back in the form of quieter relationship. I think of it sometimes like the relationship I have with my cat or my dog. You can feel how they feel. They don't talk to me, but they communicate just the same. I know when they are happy and having a great day, or when they're distressed about something, they're communicating. Our bodies communicate with us too when we slow down and really listen. And the combination of somatic work, somatic experiencing, is the form that I practice, and inner relationship focusing really helps you form these relationships that are so healing. And so I came to just love combining these two things.
Yeah, I love it too. Like I said, when I first heard about it, you know, because often we will feel something in our bodies and then we don't know what to do with it. So we just keep walking. And I love that we are getting to attend to a place where we never got to it. They never had that. And now we're able to do that. So I just love it. Okay. This was great. I probably could talk to you for another couple of hours for sure. But I appreciate your time. This was so fabulous. Thank you so much, Maureen. Is there anything you want to share just before we close?
Well, I want to thank you for having me on. The more people that better understand that their nervous system is a part of their reactions to their world and their life, the better. And I think the kinder we'll be to ourselves. And I'll just say, I do offer classes in inner relationship focusing. Some classes are starting in March for helping and healing professionals, and for all people, all interested people, in April. And so if you're interested, my website, MaureenGallagherPhD.com.
Awesome.
Thanks for having me, Monique.
Thank you for being with us.